Special 1000 podcast is brought to you in association with Crone, distributed by Farmhand.
Hi folks, I'm Jack Kennedy and welcome to this, the Special 1000 podcast by the team at Irish Farmers Journal. Cue the wolf whistle, champagne and celebratory music. Yes, brilliant. Hard to believe that we've completed 1,000 pods, but the numbers don't lie. Every week we complete hours of quality listening, and every week there are new innovations and developments in the audio side of the house here, and there will be more to come. In effect, this special podcast is a celebration about all we do on podcasting to allow you enjoy listening to stories about farming, food and rural stories. Later in the show, we'll hear from Katrina Morrissey as she caught up with Minister for Agriculture Charlie McConlogue, so we'll find out if he listens to the Irish Farmers Journal pods. First up, I'm going to dial in a number of our own team to reflect on what they enjoy about the pods, and we'll talk to some of the makers and people behind the scenes about how they are made. Yes, so I'm going to talk to an eclectic mix of people today that participate, lead and contribute in a number of the different podcasts we broadcast on a weekly basis. Siobhan Walsh, our tillage editor, is off for a few days to try and get some work done in the fields of Leash after 1,000 days of rain, but I'm going to see if she'll answer the phone. I told her I might give her a buzz.
Hello, I'm on annual leave until the 1st of May. I'll reply to your call on my return. Thank you.
Told you she was off for a few days, so obviously she's loading big bags of fertiliser into the spinner. I might try her again later. Okay, if I can't get Siobhan, I'll try and get Adam. Let's dial in Kevin. Wait for it. Before I go to Adam, let me just say we have a special giveaway this week on this, our special 1000 podcast. We're giving away 1000 euros. To enter, all you have to do is scan the QR code in the show notes or in the big advert you will see in the Farmers Journal this week. Scan the QR code and you enter, and you have the possibility of winning 1000 euros. And the terms and conditions apply, and all the small writing at the end of the end, blah, 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 blah. So, folks, that's it. 1000 podcast, special prize, special giveaway, 1000 euros, right? Adam.
Hello, Jack.
Good man, how are you?
All good.
Come here. We're doing a special podcast, Adam, here. It's the celebration of the 1000 podcast by the team at the Irish Farmers Journal. Can you believe it's 1000 already?
It's unbelievable. Unbelievable when you think back. for people maybe that wasn't that experienced in it at all, and just jumped in at the deep end.
Some people, Adam, are better at talking than writing or farming.
Yeah, it was a necessity, to be honest. You just had to.
You're talking about the whole farm TikTok piece, like, and how that started. Like, I mean, it was the COVID piece, yes, Adam, and it was the fact that we didn't know where we were going to get into shops with papers. Like,
when you think back, Jack, it was unbelievable. We were setting up with our phones on stands on tins of beans. Like, it was literally that, you know, winging it at the very beginning of TikToks and moving around the house here. Wi-Fi wasn't great. I remember I started off in the sunroom up at the other end of the house because I thought that was where the best connection was in the house. And there was four lads here in this house, and you were chaining them to chairs there in the kitchen for fear they'd make noise.
No, stop. Don't tell me anymore. I don't need to know. But I know, it is real, isn't it?
That's how stressful it was. And I suppose we were all under pressure to get it out and get it done and get it right. And yet, you know, everybody was in the house. We have a dog here called Sadie, and her routine is that when you let her in, she stays in, but invariably the lads would let her out and she'd be back around at the door where I used to be recording TikToks, rapping on the door. And the pressure was there to get it recorded, and the pressure was there to get it right. And this dog rapping on the door. But anyway, there's loads of stories of that.
Very good. Like, I mean, the other piece that comes across, Adam, in your piece, of course, is that, you know, every week we have to get the violins out, like, you know, as you detail the misery of farming in the Northwest. God help us. Like, I mean, you definitely, I was talking to Siobhan Walsh, I'm going to try and talk to Siobhan in a few minutes about the 1,000 days of rain that have happened over the last year and a half. God help us. Like, I don't know how you keep farming up your side of the country.
You know what, I get remarkable sympathy out there on the country because people genuinely think that Jack Kennedy has something in for me on TikTok in terms of every week, in terms of the abuse that I get. So it actually, it bodes well for me when I go to the concert, because they actually feel sorry for me.
You get an easy run. You get an easy run as a result, like, do you? Yeah, yeah.
But I don't know, look, it's very real, I suppose, and that's what is great. Look, if it's raining in Cavan or it's raining in the Northwest, we're getting a picture of that every week, and listeners, I think, enjoy that.
On a serious note, Adam, like, it has been an exceptional spring, you know, and again, we have the crack every week in terms of you're used to it up your part of the country, but inevitably you are, because you have more housing, you have more slurry storage, you have more feed always in place. Like, I mean, a lot of the southern half of the country, you know, expects to be out in the first couple of weeks of February, and they don't need that feed, or they don't need that housing or slurry storage.
No, I think, but what's really hitting us up here, Jack, is September and October. You know, if we're lucky, we get staying out in September, October. This year we were in sort of around the middle of September, so it's just the pure length of it now at this stage. You know, you have to win at one end, but unfortunately in winter 23-24 we've lost at both ends. That's what makes it very, very difficult now. But look, in fairness, this week, look, things have changed really, really quickly. Even the mood of farmers, to be honest, this week has changed. Speaking to farmers in March this week, you know, there's a whole different outlook in terms of what that sun can do to both farmers and cattle. It really changed the thing around. And look, things are changing very quickly. We're seeing, you know, silage already being cut down south on some farms. We're seeing fertilizer going out whole scale. We're seeing cattle being torn out. So, look, hopefully that'll continue and we'll get a good summer out of it.
Excellent. Adam, listen, I'm going to leave you. Thanks for the quick chat, and we'll talk to you more on Farm Tech Talk. Talk to you then. Excellent. Okay, so that's Adam now, right? Let me go back and try Siobhan, try and get her again.
Hi, Jack.
Siobhan, how are you?
Good.
You are live on the 1000 podcast, Siobhan, so don't swear or don't say any nasty words. I've told our listeners that you're actually on holidays. Are you releasing carbon from the soil and burning fossil fuels, I presume?
I am sowing a crop of barley that's probably going to be carbon neutral, Jack. Yeah, I'm doing loads of good for the environment.
Quick retort. Very good, very good. No, you're busy, Siobhan. Listen, I won't keep you long. It is an exceptional year, and I listened to your pod with the Minister for Agriculture, Charlie McConlogue, last week, where he was talking about the kind of tillage sector and what he's doing for it. It really is. Like, here we are recording, Siobhan, the end of April, and like literally the sod is being turned in fields all over the country. It truly is an exceptional year, isn't it?
Oh, unreal. But isn't it great at the same time that after all the wet, the crops are getting in by the end of April? Like, you know, to look on the positive, it's just been so hard on people. But to say the spring crops now and the spring cereals in particular will be planted hopefully by the end of April, the majority of them, is such good news, because we've had such a bad winter, and the winter crops, you know, while they're starting to look a bit brighter now, they're still not good crops. So it's really good to be finally sown. I think people are just happier now to be out working in the fields.
They are. Like, the mood has definitely lifted right across the country, you know, in terms of even rural people, not to mind farmers. Rural people are really kind of have turned a corner. Come here, Siobhan, do you reckon anyone listens to the Tillage Pod?
I think the Tillage Podcast is probably, if you look at the figures there, it's one of the best listened to podcasts in the farmers' journal.
Look, we all know that Farm Tech Talk is by far and away the best pod, like, you know.
Look, the Farm Tech Talk listeners, I think the Tillage Podcast comes out on a Thursday, so they listen to the Tillage Podcast, and then the Farm Tech Talk just comes up, like, so just, I think that's how you get your listeners.
But it comes up and just kind of blows everyone out. Is that what you mean? Like, is that what you...
I just mean they hang on and see what's happening on the Tech Talk once the Tillage one's over.
I hear you. They just kind of seamlessly move into it without kind of ever realising that they want to be there. No, I hear you. But come here, seriously, like, do you get good feedback on the Tillage Pod?
Oh, we do, yeah. Especially, I love to go to events and people come up and they say, oh, listen to the podcast, I love the podcast. I think, like, I listen to podcasts myself. I listen to the journal ones and other ones. I love radio. And I think especially when you're a farmer and you're in the tractor and you can listen to this kind of thing. Because if you have a busy week, and hopefully people still buy the paper, but in a week like this now where tillage farmers are up to 90 and they're in their tractor and they can listen into the Tillage Podcast, I mean, isn't that just such a great facility that they can keep up to date while they're driving along?
Yeah, sure it is. I mean, it fits. Like, I mean, you talk about being out around the country. I remember listening to one of your pods there. You had the Bean Man on, I'll call him. Like, I forget his name. Was it
John Hughes?
John Hughes, was it?
Yeah, like, Bean Man, that's what I call him too, nearly.
But he obviously sows beans from Wexford to Westmeath, I think he said on your particular pod. But come here, just did you get that in one take, or were you sitting at the kitchen table while you were having that instead of the tractor? Like,
no, we weren't. weren't in a year like this, Jack. We were out. That was a few weeks ago now, and it was one of the there was a dry weekend where people started. They mainly caught up on winter crops, and John was out sowing near a tie. It was drier ground, so he had no time to stop. So I set up on the tractor cab with him, and we had the two mics go, and he sowed away, and we had a chat. All very safe, of course. Look, he was in a big long field. I was holding his mic. He just chatted away as we were sowing the beans. And sure, that's where you get the stories. And John would say that himself, and any contractor would say that themselves. When someone sits up beside them on the tractor, that's when you hear all of the good stories, and when people relax, you know, you're out sowing someone's beans, and the farmer sits up with you, and they're just so happy to be getting a crop sown. They have a good old chat with you. So we had a good old chat in an Asher. Great to be out.
Did it ever go wrong, Siobhan? Did you ever forget to press the record button?
Oh, it's so embarrassing.
So it did? You're admitting live on air that it went wrong, yeah?
Yeah, I can't remember the particular times, but it mainly happened at events, you know, and you'd be in a rush. And you're trying to get someone at the end of an event and they're going home and you're like, oh, sugar, I forgot to press record. And then you have to do it all with them again, about 10 minutes of stuff. But I have to say, people are really good. Like when I go up to them with the mic, you know, obviously you're sticking a mic in their face and they're like, oh, jeepers, I don't know now. I wouldn't be used to doing this kind of thing. And I just say, look, it's only just a chat with me and don't mind the mic. And people are saying, oh, you can edit it anyway, can't you? And I'm saying, yeah, we can edit it. But to be honest, I generally don't. And I don't. Like, and Claire and Jerome on the desk will tell you that. Like, I don't edit it. I literally have
it
a chat
is what
with
it is like. Yeah, exactly.
And they talk away. These people who are like afraid of doing it are just because the people we have on, farmers, agronomists, whatever they are, they know their trade, they know their job, and they're just having a chat about what they do every day. So there's never any need to edit it, like, hey, unless, of course, they say an odd curse or something.
Yeah, correct. Come here. You're trying to take over this podcast now, like, this isn't the tillage podcast now. But come here, before I leave you and let you get back to your work, you were instrumental in the startup of the Young Stock Pod as well. Like, you've a good team of our own people talking to young people all over the country every week on this pod.
Yeah, and outside of the country as well. I've had plenty of people from abroad on the Young Stock as well. What makes the Young Stock podcast is the team. It's the fact that, you know, there's 12 or 13 of us there working on it together, from the editorial team who recorded to Kevin, who's on the desk editing it.
What's the qualifications here for getting on the Young Stock podcast? Do you have to be under the age of 20 or 25?
You don't qualify anyway, Jack.
I'm way outside that age bracket, but we
went to a mock age, so it's 17 to 35.
I thought they've gone to 40 now, no?
No.
Okay. Yeah.
It's great because we've such variety on it. You know, you could have Sarah McIntosh talking to someone about their career in agri-food, and then you've Peter and Gary talking to someone who's selling machinery, or, you know, I had a grain trader on who was in Brazil in January there a few weeks ago, or some of the lads had someone, you know, working out in Australia. I remember one particular one I really enjoyed, a guy that worked for Dalton's Chancellor's Mills, and he was out in Australia on just a year's break or whatever. So there's just such variety on it. I think that's what really makes it. And people, we do it on a rota, so you kind of build up a guest that you really want to get on it as well. You know, people put a lot of thought into the that they have on it.
Excellent. Hey, listen, I leave you. The soundproofing in that Massey must be exceptional. I can hear
sure,
you.
It's a Massey, What more can I say? It's not red.
Leave it in the shed. Excellent. Siobhan, 100%. Thanks for that. We'll chat again soon, and we'll be listening to the Tillage and the Young Stock podcast. Thanks for that. Talk to you later.
Just the sincerity in your eyes again.
I don't know. Right, folks, next up, you won't know this guy, but he's the guy behind the scenes, and actually he's behind a lot of our cameras around the country as well. Philip Doyle, welcome to the 1000 podcast.
Thanks very much, Jack.
Philip, you know us and we know you. I mean, we're not journalists. We're probably more farmers than journalists. But when we started doing podcasts, I'm sure you got some hairy quality podcast.
Well, to be fair, I'm not a podcaster or an editor of podcasts. We all suited very well there. Yeah, we definitely did. People wanted to do podcasts. The idea was there, just kind of making it happen. And it's moved on quite a bit, Jack, to where we're sitting here today.
Yeah. You listen to a lot of podcasts. Like, what do you enjoy in a podcast? Like, what do you listen to?
I think I want to kind of get lost in the podcast. I want it to be comfortable to listen to. There's always an argument here, you know this, sitting around the editorial editorial table, we discuss the length of a podcast all the time. Mm. Where a lot of people think 15 minutes, 20 minutes. I'm an hour kind of guy, Jack. I want to get lost in it. I'm driving down the country to do a job. Yeah, I don't be filming with my phone. So I like a good hour long podcast. But I like different things. I like stories. I like information. It depends on my mood, really. And that's what we're trying to do with the Farmers Journal. So many different podcasts.
But like, Philip, would you listen to Farm Tech Talk? Would you listen to The Good Room? Would you listen to The Young Stock Pod?
Yeah, contractually, I think I have to, you know, it's in my contract to listen to it. No, I do. I'm heavily invested in it. And to be fair, I don't edit it. So like, we've a small team here. There's only three of us on our multimedia team. Four, we include Kevin from Traction there. And it's actually Kevin, Jerome and Claire who edit the podcast. And to be fair, while it wasn't that scary for me, it was probably scarier for some of them. Like Claire, God love her, and she's pretty much working with Siobhan there on the Tillage podcast every week. She's one of our photographers, so she had to learn how to do podcasts, and she does it extremely well now.
But isn't it amazing, like how media is evolving, like, and it has been evolving probably. Like, I mean, it's amazing that we're on 1,000 podcasts already, you know. But I mean, like, that's the culmination of, you know, 9, maybe almost 10 years of podcasting at this stage. Like, it's almost second nature, and it suits what farmers are into, Philip. Like, as you see, like, you're interrupting farmers while they're doing their little bit of work or whatever, but they can be listening to, you know, the pods. Like, it fits. Like,
that's a big thing. And, you know, I my take on this is that the Farmers Journal should almost have a radio station, and our podcasts are a radio station. If a guy is out in the, or a girl out lambing a yo, or out as this week because the weather's turned well and they're out in the tractors, they want to be listening to stuff about what they're interested in, and they're clearly interested in farming. It's great to be able to give them content to do that. But you're right, the journey where it's gone to, like, where we started recording on mobile phones, trying to find our way. Like you said, you're not a journalist. I'm technically not a photographer. Claire's not a podcast editor, but we've found our way. So we've gone from recording on our mobile phones to adding a wire to our mobile phone to sitting in our nice, almost plush studio here with a proper recorder and mics. But the problem is, Jack, the problem in terms of the technology, but it's a plus in terms of our podcasts, our people are all over the country, which allows them to tell the stories regionally. Like when you're talking to Adam Woods and he's talking about that Northwest piece, they're coming in there. Now, from a technological point of view, we have to make sure that they have the right equipment and that it can sound good. Mm. But the fact that we can sit here now and ring the guys we rang today, it's a new world.
Ah, it is, like, you know, but there is a bit of, like, we're shooting the breeze here, having the chest, but there is a bit of work that goes into them, packaging them, marketing them, you know, getting them kind of, I call it, ready for digesting by and listening to by farmers and listeners across the country. Like, there's a bit of work goes into them.
Oh, absolutely. Huge, huge. It's a massive team in behind here. You know, people hear the voice, they hear Jack Kennedy talking, but in the background, you know yourself, the amount of, I'm looking here, your bits of paper, all your notes, the amount of work you put into it, then it'll go to a marketing team, because there's no point in recording this if nobody listens to it. And luckily we're getting really, really good listens, but there's a huge team in behind that to take this recording, to edit it, to put it out there and to get it into people's earphones.
Hey, you're not allowed to enter the special giveaway for the 1,000 podcasts. You know that?
Actually, I was looking at that. €1,000. I found it hard enough to get you to sign off to buy a microphone. What? €1,000. Didn't know we had that much. That's great.
It's a special one. Excellent. Philip, 100% good to have the chat. Thanks for that.
Thank you, Jack.
Hiya.
Hello, how are you? How are you keeping?
Good, how are you?
I'm in the podcast room with Jack Kennedy. We're all listening to you.
Oh God, are you serious?
Absolutely. We can see you as well.
We can see you.
We can see you.
We're like Anton Deck, me and Jack.
Yeah. I don't even have a tap of makeup on me.
Oh, good. That's okay.
Feel free to take a call from Jack for like 2 minute chat on just off the cuff on the podcast.
Can you give me just 10 minutes?
No, we're doing it now.
Like, we're doing it now.
This is it. Like, we're live.
No.
Yeah.
Just give me 10 minutes, will you?
Just
10 minutes.
Look, we don't have all the time in the world. Like, I mean,
I know.
I'm not sure if you realize that Jack Kennedy is the editor of the Irish Farmers Journal.
I know, he's amazing. Who's she talking to?
I want to deliver good content for this. Just give me 10 minutes to get my head ready. Stop. Can you give me 10 minutes?
No. Kira needs 10 minutes, so while we're waiting, here's part one of the minister's interview with Katrina. Later, we'll have part two after we hear from Katrina herself.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this special episode celebrating our landmark 1000th podcast. I'm delighted to be joined by a very distinguished guest who's taken some time out from his hectic schedule to be with us today. Minister for Agriculture, Charlie McConlough, you're very welcome to the Irish Farmers Journal 1000 podcast.
Thanks, Katrina, and thanks for the invitation to be with you on this, which is a very significant milestone for the Farmers Journal and for the podcast series. And just to congratulate at the outset, the wonderful service that the podcast has provided through the exceptionally, obviously, informed staff you have at the Farmers Journal to the farming community across the country. I think it has been a great departure. I know many people get great value from it, and it gets listened to from all places, from the car on the way to a match to the tractor in the field, and unfortunately more in the last few weeks in the house listening to the rain as well. It's been a great service and one I listen to regularly myself too. Well done to you and all of the team, and good to join with you today for the 1000.
Thanks very much. And actually, the volume in the tractor is a source of debate in the office. We have actually put up the volume on the podcast so that people in tractors and milking parlours can hear it a little bit better. But Minister, I was looking back through the timelines, and you've actually been centrally involved in agricultural politics ever since we did our first podcast. That was back in 2015. Firstly, you were agriculture, the opposition spokesperson on agriculture, and then more recently, obviously, as minister and the key decision maker. So it's really appropriate that you can take this time to look both back and forward at events in the farming industry. Later on, I'd like to ask you what it's like, you know, being a politician in Ireland these days and the challenges that that brings. But first, I'd like to have a look back. Our first podcast was published on the 31st of March, 2015. And that was a really major milestone for farming in Ireland, because the following day, milk quotas were abolished. As you know, we thought Ireland could throw off the shackles, turn on the taps and produce as much milk as possible. But now, nearly 10 years on, the shackles are being reintroduced again through environmental regulation, changes to the nitrates derogation. Aside from dairy expansion, we've also seen other huge milestones. So things like Brexit, which, you know, we debated from 2016 until it happened in 2020. European Commission's Green Deal and the various CAP reforms that have followed that. We had beef factory protests and a lot more. So from your kind of front seat, your front row seat in government looking at this, what do you think has been the best thing to happen to Irish agriculture in that time, and also the worst thing?
Yeah, listen, I mean, it's been, I suppose it's about 8 years now since that, or 9 years since the podcast started, but 8 years since I would have been appointed as spokesperson for Agriculture, Food and the Marine, the Fianna Fáil opposition spokesperson, and then coming up in 4 years this the end of the summer since I've been minister as well. So there's been a lot of change over that time, but agriculture has remained very robust and strong during that. And like, I think that there's always different challenges. I mean, and there's annual challenges where it's the weather cycles, which bring its vagaries every year. Or indeed, you know, since I've become minister, obviously the big challenge has been the war in Ukraine and the impact that had in relation to supply chains, in relation to prices. And prior to that then as well, the Brexit decision and the actual outcome of the Brexit deal was early on in the first 6 to 9 months of my tenure as minister as well, and was obviously a particularly significant moment. And I suppose in many ways that was, you know, that was about dodging the real negative impact that Brexit could have been had there been a no-deal Brexit, because the stakes were massively high for the agriculture sector, more so than any, because of the fact that, you know, almost 40% of our agri-food products go to the British market compared to somewhere more in the teens generally across the economy, 13-14%, but in agriculture was 40%. So that was the most significant, I think, real danger and challenge. And at government level, everybody worked collectively and really strong cross-sectoral response as well to try and work to make sure that a deal would come in place. And also then subsequent to that as well, that in terms of the new extra red tape that is now involved, which is unavoidable, but which we sought to minimise, but that hasn't impacted on trade or agri-food trade into Britain. And thankfully, that has held up. Obviously, then, the illegal invasion of Ukraine had massive implications last year and the year before. And we worked hard then across the sector as well to try and address that and deal with that. But I think maybe looking back, you know, on my own 4 years as minister, that aside, probably the most significant piece policy-wise then has been the implementation of the delivery of the new Common Agricultural Policy, which will run up to 2027. Last year was the first year of that. and in terms of the various new schemes and the implementation of the new structures. And then the year or two, certainly before that, I put very significant effort into working right across the agriculture and farming sector to consult and engage with representative organizations, but also directly with farmers by traveling the country to engage with everyone, to make sure that the new cap would be as fair as possible and as practical as possible for all farmers and fair to all parts of the country too, and all sectors. I suppose the significant the achievement and probably most proud of in that is delivering the budgetary increase from a national point of view to back that CAP program. Because working with Minister Michael McGrath, the public expenditure minister at the time, we secured and committed to a 50% increase in the national co-funding of CAP. And that was the largest ever increase there's been in CAP between CAP programs. And as much as we might engage and consult with farmers in relation to the structure of it, ultimately, it's the funding and we're putting into it, which is massively important. And I was particularly, you know, glad to be able to deliver that and then see that feed through into much stronger schemes this time around then too.
I've often wondered myself, you know, the increase in the budget. Do you ever get somewhat frustrated by the logistics that then some, you know, new CAP, new schemes, we've seen some IT and, you know, delivery frustrations there to farmers. Do you ever get frustrated that you've done the major job of, you know, increasing the budget, but then the rollout of it just has those potholes?
Yeah, listen, I mean, that can certainly be frustrating, but I mean, the delivery of a new CAP is a massive logistical challenge. And that takes a massive amount of effort and preparation by all of the team right across the Department of Agriculture, Food and the Marine. So listen, you engage, you put the structure in place, but in terms of the schemes and what you plan for and the budgets, but then the actual implementation of that, it means the building of an entire building of a new system to deliver it, because this CAP is very different in many ways from the last one. And also, so that's a logistical operation on that side, but it was also puts a lot of pressure on farmers and on advisors too. So last year was particularly challenging because of that. But I think overall, and obviously Acres has been the one which has been most challenging, and we've taken steps to seek to address that. But overall, I think in terms of the implementation of the new schemes, because everybody had applied for each scheme again for the very first time, and all of that was new. So the implementation of that, and obviously we adjusted the payment dates at the start of the year and wrote to every farmer back in March last year to inform them of what their payments would be. Their payment dates would be in September and October. And we set those dates according to the date that we felt we could deliver the best service possible and pay farmers on those dates. And that did work out, and we did, the department then did deliver. I know obviously many farm organizations made an issue of that and felt, you know, didn't like, and nobody liked to see it put back a week or two or up to a month in one instance. But it was important to make sure that we could deliver what we said and told farmers we do. And apart from the acre scheme, there was in the very high, you know, in the 90% of farmers paid and across each of the schemes on the dates that we set. So, and that worked much more smoothly, I think, than it would have had in the first year of previous CAP programs. The one scheme which has been really frustrating for all of us then was the acre scheme. But again, we've worked to try and make sure that we accommodate and support farmers best possible. And obviously, the decision I made to last year and again this year to get and find the wherewithal to accept all acres farmers into the schemes put some pressure on, but it's a more challenging system to put in place. But we did move then back a couple of months ago to issue interim payments to farmers of either 4,000 or 5,000 euro, depending on whether you're in the general stream or the cooperation stream, to reflect that. And the team is now working to make sure that those balancing payments issued by June.
Can you give an undertaking to farmers now that there won't be any future, that this was year one of the CAP and that year one of getting that many farmers into acres, that there won't be any further delays on payments and obviously subsequent income delays for the farmers?
Yeah, well, listen, that's certainly the objective. And I think across the other schemes, they've worked well. So this year now we're pulling the dates back to what they would traditionally have been and intend to fully deliver on that. And then acres, listen, that's still evolving. The team are now still building out the system to pay the balancing payments. And certainly the objective of all of that is to make sure that come this autumn, we're in a position to avoid the difficulties that we're seeing last autumn. But it's still an evolving piece of work, but one that everybody's working hard on.
You mentioned it there already, but the Russian invasion of Ukraine and that ripple effect that came out through agriculture across Europe. Obviously, you don't have a crystal ball. Nobody in 2015 would have seen a Russian invasion of Ukraine having an effect on fertilizer prices, you know, doubling, tripling fertilizer prices for farmers in Ireland. You don't have a crystal ball, but do you see any tiny cracks or inklings of problems that farmers, you think that Irish farmers should think about preparing for?
As you say, the couple of things probably which came, which we didn't predict in the last number of years, was Brexit and Ukraine, and we didn't see those coming. So you just never know, and things can take off at any stage. I do think the lesson, particularly of the war in Ukraine, is that, you know, there can be no room for complacency in relation to food security, and also how delicate supply chains can be. And how they can be disrupted. So, you know, again, I think, and this is something I've been making the case for at European level, the importance of that being recognised across the EU in terms of the CAP budget and bringing the CAP and agriculture more central in and food, the food security aspect of that more central in the policy arena at European level, and particularly in terms of increasing the budget as we go forward into future CAPs. I think what we are seeing is, you know, farming continuing to evolve and meet challenges. Like, we're seeing significant adoption of new technologies at farm level, whereby, you know, like, for example, the last 2 years, we've seen a 30% reduction in chemical use of chemical fertilizer. Now, that's something, you know, that people would have, you know, you couldn't have predicted. You'd have said, surely if there was going to be that would have a significant impact in terms of production capacity. But that hasn't been the case. It's a much more better utilization of chemical fertilizer, and particularly a much better utilization of organic manure or organic fertilizer that's contributing to that. Obviously, the increased price last year
major incentive
was a driver in that. But it drove on a change that was happening at farm level. We've seen the adoption of low emission slurry spreading, meaning that, you know, people utilize their slurry much better and much more effectively over the course of the year, and spread it when it's needed, where it's needed, using the less slurry equipment means that you can, you know, it's much more usable in a grazing platform than it would have been previously. And that's then twofold benefit of better utilization of slurry, and better, you know, from a cost point of view, better, but it's also then leading to displacement of chemical fertilizer otherwise. But also then we're seeing, you know, increasing adoption of clover, multi-species sward, and also soil sampling in, you know, the toolkit array which farmers are using. And that's leading to significant improvement and benefit there too. Better farming, more profitable farming, and also more, you know, a more sustainable way of doing it too. So listen, I think that's the transition that's underway. And the objective as we go forward is to first and foremost have a focus on farm incomes and doing and backing, you know, the improvement of farm incomes, but that being driven by supporting farmers to produce food while supporting farmers to become more sustainable in how they do it. And farmers are doing, you know, I'd say of all sectors in our economy are really leading out in that.
If I could bring you back to one thing you mentioned there, the awareness of the importance of food security and also some of the CAP simplification moves that are there at the minute. Will that last, do you think? What's your experience of Europe? Is an awareness of food security only there in the immediate aftermath of the Ukrainian war? And will it be forgotten about just as quickly? Or is that a lasting effect? And do you think that that will have the effect of encouraging a separate environmental budget so that the CAP budget can remain focused on quality food production?
I think it should be lasting, because probably, you know, over the last 30 plus years, there hasn't been an event like that which really challenged the complacency around food security in the way that we did the last couple of years as a result of the illegal invasion of Ukraine. So I do believe that will impact, and that will
have a longer tail.
You know, yeah, I think so. I think it leaving an imprint on people's minds of the fact that there had been a complacency had developed there. And we have, as policymakers and certainly as farming ministers and as a minister from Ireland, certainly I see it as key role of myself to make sure that that there is that lasting impact and that it does lead to a reset, because we have seen budgets shrinking in real terms, in terms of the cap budget at European level. I've outlined earlier how we increased by a record amount the national co-funding of the cap, but that, you know, that's against the backdrop where the cap budget has not been rising at European level. And we need to see that reset and that become better funded again. And then in the environmental space, while there will be policies and ask put in place, it's really important that is separate to the cap budget, that it is incentive led, but there's funding for that.
Do you think that we will have a separate environmental budget that farmers can draw from in the same way as they can draw from the food production budget?
I think we need to insist. I think that's a battle. That's a battle because certainly, I mean, in terms of the discussion at European level and throughout the development of this cap, a big part of the narrative and the policy push and pressures was to use more of the cap for environmental reasons as opposed to food production and food security reasons. I was very much, as Ireland was, at the forefront of looking to protect the budget and make sure, you know, that food production was prioritized in that, and that any other ask would be that we would see separate funding for it. But that has been a big pressure point at European level. So we can't, you know, that is something I expect a debate and a battle that we will have to continue to press for, and we have to point to the disruption and the impact of the Ukrainian war and the food, the supply disruptions that led to as a rationale as to why that should be the case. Certainly at national level, we're putting the funding in. We've obviously put the future, the climate and nature fund in place to run from 2026 onwards, and that's separate to CAP, and that's about supporting environmental incentivizing environmental actions where people are participating in them. But we need to make sure that's the case at European level.
Apologies for interrupting, but can you give farmers an idea of what type of scheme is the word I'll use that they might be able to draw from that fund? Is there any concrete thoughts on what might come out of it?
Oh, well, I think it's something we'll be consulting on. I think on the plus side, like if you look at the 25, you know, the MAC, the Chagas curve, MAC curve, which lays out the different measures that we can take to 2030 that'll achieve a 25% reduction in farming emissions. There's over 60% of those steps that will achieve that reduction in emissions. Over 60% of the road can be travelled in a way that actually enhances profitability. So, which is very, you know, which shows that you can become more sustainable and become more profitable along the way. But then, in terms of how we adapt further to that, for example, how we, you know, look at the potential for feed additives to contribute, because there's real significant capacity there for that to contribute in the time ahead. I see real space around that to be able to try and draw down some funding to support a reduction of emissions while making sure we continue to be as productive in terms of producing beef or lamb or dairy.
I am going to put words in your mouth now. Do you see farmers being able to draw a subsidy from that fund for feeding the methane reducing feed additives?
I think that's one of the areas I'd certainly want to explore to be able to do that, to be able to back the application of that. We're putting a lot of investment in at the moment through Chagas in particular to researching the capacity of feed additives to work in a grass-based environment as opposed to a housed environment. And the results in terms of our animals are strong and the feedback is strong. So that's certainly a big space I see, and one I'd like to see that Nature Fund brought into play for.
Good morning.
Kira, how are you?
I'm good, Jack. How are you?
Kira, look, before we go, the good room. Where is the good room?
The good room is always at the front of the house. Did you have a good room going up now?
We did. Sure, no one ever went in there, like, you know what I mean? It was the good room, like, you know, so we just kept the door closed, like, so it looked good and it was nice and tidy and the cushions were in the right place and all that, like, yeah.
Yeah, but when you went in there, wasn't that where you got all the juicy chats?
Ah, sure it was. At Christmas time, so, especially. Like,
exactly,
say, like,
exactly.
Yeah.
And that is where we found the title, The Good Room, because it's where you get all the good information and you have a good cup of tea. The only thing, Jack, was the whole concept was about the team having a chat over the cup of tea and biscuits, but journal just never forked out for the biscuits.
Ah, no, she couldn't afford the biscuits, for God's sake. They're bad for you anyway, Ciara. They're bad for you, like, you know what I mean? Don't mind the biscuits. Like, but come here, for anyone that's listening to this and doesn't realise what we're talking about the podcast from the Irish Country Living team. It's called The Good Room. Like, so it's where you get the best chats. That's what you're saying, Ciara.
It's where we get the best chats. And I guess it was the opportunity to bring the pages of Irish Country Living alive with the team, talking about the topics that were in the paper, the articles that were in the paper every week.
Yeah, come here. Who's been your best guest? Who has been your best guest in the Good Room? Or what has been the best chat? It doesn't have to be the guest. What has been the best chat?
We have always enjoyed when Nevin has joined the chats, you know, giving us all the recipes.
I love Nevin
and
the Irish Country Living, for God's sake. But, now you want to put him into the podcast as well? Like, oh my God.
Absolutely.
Like, this is a Nevin loving all the time. Nevin loving. Like,
but we'd see, we used to make it even better by doing a bit of wine pairing with his recipes, and you know, that always made things very interesting. Like, you know,
we should start that at ploughing. We should start doing something like that at ploughing. Like, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that always got a lot of attention, though, is the Miriams. As you know, Miriam is our agony aunt at the back of Irish Country Living. And what we did in a lot of the Good Rooms was we presented the topic that Miriam brought to the table and her answer, but we got to row in and say whether we thought that she was right or wrong, and we gave our unsolicited advice in terms of living near the in-laws. Apparently one mother-in-law was very upset about someone hiring a cleaner, and that got a lot of traction. But I guess it went from everything to, I guess, everyday issues like that, to one person having a problem coming to terms with death wishes and cremation. So I mean, with Miriam, the topics are very broad. Absolutely excellent.
Listen, I can't wait for the next one. When is the next one? What's the plan?
We are going to be rolling out the Good Room on a more frequent basis over the summer, but we're really going to be focusing on rural issues and rural topics that are going to be more prevalent in Irish Country Living in the coming weeks and months.
Excellent. Thanks, Ciara. Thanks for that. Talk to you later. That was Ciara, editor of the Irish Country Living. Folks, before I forget, remember, we're giving away €1,000 to celebrate our 1,000 podcast. All you have to do is get the link in the show notes, or you'll see the QR code in the full page advert in this week's Irish Farmers Journal. Yeah, €1,000 giveaway. Wow. Terms and conditions apply, obviously, and all that. But don't forget to see it, and don't forget to enter.
That's a great prize. €50, one for all. Is the most I've ever
how are you like come on
anything.
Like, you know what I mean, it's a journal
I
now you're talking about
I won the Farmer's Journal Christmas table quiz 2 years in a row, and it nearly killed you to give us a voucher
what
for
was
50
it?
euro.
A bottle of wine was it? No, oh, 50 euros
no then. You give absolutely diddly squat the first time until I kicked up a song and dance, and when we won it again, myself and Brian Murphy and someone else,
Diddly Squat, did I hear you were actually on Diddly Squat's farm?
I was at Diddly Squat, yes. I was, when we detoured when we were over Cheltenham
at last, like. So, like, yeah. I mean, well, if you're listening, I mean, we have sympathy for you. Like, you were while you were perusing around Cheltenham, we better do this.
I think we just got our ad for the €1,000 giveaway. That's absolutely brilliant.
Katrina, how are you?
Good, Jack. Good, thank you.
Hey, come here. You caught up with the minister. How did you make him stop talking? Like,
the minister, in fairness to him, has a very busy diary, but he did give us 45 minutes
but
of
Katrina,
his time.
He doesn't help himself. Sure, we can't talk. The minute you ask him a question, like, he just keeps talking and talking.
And I would say that is a trait characteristic of all politicians. But look, at the man has been, I suppose, centrally involved in politics, agricultural politics, since we started our very first podcast, because he was the opposition spokesperson on agriculture for Fianna Fáil for several years, and then he obviously has been the minister for agriculture for the last number of years. So he's actually had a front row seat to a lot of what's happened, what we've covered in our podcast. So I talked to him about the highs and lows, I suppose, as he saw it from a ministerial seat, and then pressed him a little bit on, you know, this competing land use. There's a lot of demand for land at the minute.
Correct.
It's not going to get, you know, we've targets for forestry, we've targets for organics, we've targets for solar panels, we've targets for anaerobic digestion. We have derogation farmers out there hunting for land.
Correct.
We've tillage farmers who are expected to meet
a
target.
You're making me uneasy. no, listen, and obviously I'm in jest. Like, I mean, look at it. is great to get the minister on, and it's good, it is good that we have that link and that we have that contact and that we can actually kind of dialogue with him on a serious basis, like, you know, because, you know, without, he is the central person, as you say, in terms of the Department of Agriculture and the in his position. So excellent. So you had a good chat. So I'm looking forward to hearing some of the answers on that. Anything jump out at you, Katrina?
I actually think that he kind of expressed a little bit of reservation, and not explicitly, but I took from what he was saying that he is a little bit concerned about that competition for land, kind of highly productive food producing land, as I put it to him, going under solar panels in areas where there's huge demand for it for all types of agriculture, including tillage, which has a massive climate target plan. You know, we're trying to get to 400,000 hectares, as Siobhan Walsh tells us daily in the Farmers Journal. Yeah. I just think that is indicative of maybe where he's thinking.
Yeah.
The land use review is coming, but it's not there yet. Yeah. And some policy might be coming on that side.
But come here, leaving all that aside, like, isn't it a tough gig, like, in fairness, in terms of any politicians, I'm not just talking about Mr. McConnell, but any politicians, isn't it a tough gig, like, as they go up and down the country, like, listening to all of us whinging?
Oh, it is, especially people like yourself, Jack. But no, in all seriousness, I asked him what it was like to be a politician these days, and I put it to him, you know, lots of farmers might have seen that clip of quite an aggressive confrontation back in Athlone in January. So we talked a bit about that, and he gave, I suppose, a perspective on how he deals with that type of stuff, you know, that kind of social media demand for aggression and, you know, showboating, I'll call it.
Yep.
So he talked a little bit about that, which I found just very interesting from his point of view.
Excellent. Listen, you're obviously are and were very involved with the news podcast. I'll talk to Amy Ford on that in a bit, you know, but I mean, that captures all that's happening kind of in farming news and rural views every week. Like, it's a good job, isn't it?
It's great. We have lots of people who tell us that they love getting it as a kind of a pointer, what to go and read in the Farmers Journal, or a summary if they're driving along and they want to catch up with what has happened. It's been going a long time. I mean, obviously our first podcast was on the eve of quota abolition, as you know, you were a central one in that, but
yeah,
we try and cover all the topics every week.
That was back in 2015, so it must be
31st of March 2015, the very first podcast, the eve of quota abolition. We thought we were going to be turning on the taps and never turning them off, but obviously things have come full circle nearly now. Shackles kind of been reintroduced with the environmental regulation and the nitrates changes. It was a quick 9 years to go from thinking that the floodgates are going to open to now the dam being reconstructed.
Okay, Katrina, leave it at that. Thanks for that.
I'd like to move on, Minister, to the question of land, which is always a hot topic in Ireland. And it seems to me like there is a major problem coming down the tracks in that we have a raft of targets set for different land uses. And I'm just going to list some of them here. You'll know them off the top of your head, but for the benefit of our listeners, Gaeltacht has said that its target is 100,000 hectares of new planting by 2050, derogation in order to meet the lower 220 kilo limit, an extra 27,500 hectares of land is needed unless cows are to be removed. The tillage target under the Climate Action Plan is to have an extra 52,000 hectares by 2030. Solar panels, we're looking at 16,000 hectares to meet the 2030 targets. Anaerobic digestion, if we follow the plan and the targets, would require 120,000 hectares of grass silage. We have 80,000 hectares of land needed to grassland, farmed grassland, to be managed differently in order to meet rewetting targets. When you add all that up, that's coming to about 400,000 hectares of land. But I think it was Mark Twain said it, they are not making any more of it. So how can we have all of these competing targets? And is it not a bit disingenuous of your department, of you as minister, to set targets that are obviously at odds with each other? Because this land, there isn't enough land to go around.
No, but it's not disingenuous. I mean, it's about bringing new options to farmers in relation to how they can contribute, not just in relation to food production, but also in relation to energy production, for example. So, you know, the capacity for anaerobic digestion through the biomethane target there is that by the end of the decade, we would be able to produce 10% of our total national usage of gas from farms. So I think, you know, the role and the importance of land has never been more crucial because it has there's so much it can contribute. And for me, that means that farmers who hold that land, that their role is even going to be more important than it ever was. And I suppose from a government point of view, then our objective is to give farmers as many options and choices around how they to use that land and gain income from that land as possible. And obviously, really importantly, it's the farmer's choice as to how they would utilize that and how they would avail of that. I think farming and food production has a really strong future, and I think the curve will be in a different direction this coming generation than it was over the last. I think if we look at the last 30 years or such, food has become cheaper in the context of the wider economy and other asks on people's weekly expense basket, it has been the income from farms has become less compared to what other was available in other aspects of the economy. Part of that has been down to the fact that we've moved in the last 30 years to become quite a developed country and economy with opportunities that wouldn't have been there before. But alongside that, agricultural prices have remained pegged to what to world prices, and therefore hasn't risen in the way other jobs and opportunities in the economy has. And that's put pressure on in terms of agricultural generation renewal and the attractiveness of farming. But I think now over the next generation, the farming of the land and the utilization of the land is going to be more important than it ever was. I think food is going to be more needed because the world population by 2050 is due to hit 10 billion people. And because of climate challenges around the world, it's becoming more difficult to produce food in many climate vulnerable countries who previously would have produced it. So therefore, in a country like ours, while climate change will impact, we still have a great capacity to produce food, and it's really important that we do that. So, and then alongside that, then there is the capacity to produce for energy, and also carbon farming, forestry as well, and also making sure that in terms of how we farm and use land, that we see a regeneration of biodiversity, which has become eroded in every country in the last 30, 40 years. So that provides opportunities and provides income opportunities for farmers as well. Firstly, in terms of food production income, but also in those others. But it also, on the flip side of that, it does mean land would become more valued and more sought after too, and the price of land can go up as a result of the fact that it has more capacity to generate income.
Well, I can tell you, I'm in South Tipperary and there's no shortage of competing interests for land. We've solar farms, we've large buyers of land, good tillage farmers who want to expand, dairy farmers in derogation. I sometimes think while everything you've said is correct, it sounds a little bit more abstract. When it comes down to it, the land that is in the parish, if there is a solar farm developer, for example, coming offering €1,200 an acre versus the neighbouring farmer producing, whether that be dairy, tillage or beef, they haven't a hope of competing. Is there a danger that farmers will go broke trying to get land to keep their own family farm business in operation?
Farmers own the land at the moment. So it's farm families that have the land. Obviously, as land becomes available, the margins to be gained by any particular use has a significant impact then in what direction it goes. There are new uses there coming in for potential example solar, and I think that's something we'll have to monitor closely in relation to the policy environment around that. But what I want to see happening and what I'd like to encourage is better crossover and cooperation between the sectors too. So for example, and that's why recently there and we got approval from Europe in the last few weeks for the 70% grant aid where farmers are importing slurry. So like if you have a livestock farm or a tillage farm which is not utilizing as much or has more capacity to utilize organic slurry, there's no reason why by the proper integration of sectors that we can't see more organic slurry spread and indeed stored as necessary in those farms to be utilized on the farm, displacing chemical fertilizer in the process, but also making sure that farms that might be under pressure in terms of the 250 to 220 and the derogation that it releases some of the pressure and those, but also as well spreads the load as well in relation to making sure we keep that derogation by managing water quality. So we have to look at how we can have the sectors speak to one another and integrate with one another as strongly as possible. But there's no doubt that the competition for land is going to be stronger because the options that are there are strong, and particularly not just with the energy piece, but obviously with quotas, you know, in the last 10 years, quota has been reduced. It means now that that there's more sectors of and competing for land that mightn't have been doing so, as much before. So because obviously, you know, you can expand now in dairying, and obviously that has been put in particular, that has been putting some pressure on other sectors, tillage and other livestock.
You mentioned there, and I was interested to hear you mention it. So do you see a point where the government, the Department of Agriculture, will specify a type of land that is not suitable, for example, for solar panels? You know, there is an argument, there's a cohort of people out there who say that top quality food producing land shouldn't go under something like solar panels. Do you agree with that? Where do you stand on that? And what kind of a policy do you think might come down the tracks?
I think it's something we have to look at. Obviously, it's early days. So, there hasn't been much yet. But listen, it's something I'm open to engaging with, you know, stakeholders and representative organizations on as to how we manage all that piece. The land use review is underway at the moment, which, you know, is designed to try and give advice in relation to good utilization of land and working with farmers to maximize its return for everyone. I think it's early days. There is real potential there to contribute, but questions such as where it's most appropriate is something I think we have to reflect on further and scope out a bit more, because it's only something we're starting to see the impact of now.
So when is the land use review going to be complete? I know it's coming in stages, so how close are we to having an overall picture to make decisions on?
There's a consultation, I think, ongoing now, has started now at the moment. So it's in the consultation phase. The initial, a big part of it was at the start, trying to get a proper assessment of what land types there are across the country and get that proper inventory in place. And then it's about engaging and consulting and listen. The key thing then going forward in terms of anything we do, in my view, is the importance of putting farmers at the center of that, and making sure, you know, farmers ultimately are the ones that decide how they manage their farm. But I think from a state point of view, it's going to be beneficial to have a full and really the first overall, you know, snapshot of our land type, the potential for land uses, so it can guide general policy making then.
The newly installed Taoiseach Simon Harris last week criticised what he called finger wagging and unwarranted criticism of the farming sector on greenhouse gas emissions. There really is a gulf between some elements of the farming sector and some elements of the environmental lobby. And there's real caricatures there. Some people who describe tree huggers who want everybody living in communes with wolves roaming around rewilded countryside, and versus farmers who want to christen their children with glyphosate and run their farms like factories. It's obviously there's a huge silent majority in the middle there. But if you had kind of one shot or one argument to convince people to transform that relationship between farming and the environment so that it isn't so polarizing, how would you go about it?
Yeah, no, and listen, this is something I've been to the forefront now, you know, on trying to correct the last couple of years, because agriculture, there has been far too much finger wagging and far too much, undermining and blaming of farmers totally unfairly, in the wider debate in relation to sustainability. So, and I think the way for us to address that is simply tell the story of what farmers are actually doing. The agriculture sector is reducing its emissions. They reduced in 2022. I expect to see whenever the 2023 figures are reduced that they'll be further reduced. There's really significant working on a farm level. The farming sector, actually, of all sectors of the economy, I think is the one which is transitioning really strongly and doing a lot of work, and farmers are just getting on with the business. And even, you know, that move in the last couple of years of seeing a reduction of 30% in the use of chemical fertilizer is a reflection of that. So I think the setting of the targets was quite a contested space. Obviously, I fought hard to make sure we get a target which would be deliverable for agriculture, and that's set at 25%, whereas the economy-wide target is 51% by 2030. And obviously, that means some sectors are well above the 50. And that led to it being contested. But I think the targets are in place now. The job is about getting on delivering, and agriculture is doing that and will continue to do that. And really importantly, alongside that, keep producing the food, which is so important. So we just need to focus more on telling the story and also showing the progress, because farming has been making progress, and that's going to be something we'll build momentum on now in the time ahead. And you know, it should be an example for the rest of the economy, and we just need to make sure people should be using it as an example and not unfairly targeting it.
Minister, thanks a million. I'm going to move on from kind of the policy areas now and just to dig a little bit deeper into what it's like being a politician these days, because we've seen a real rise in kind of threats and intimidation of politicians. We had Minister Roderick O'Gorman had masked protesters outside his own home last week. Many of our listeners may have seen footage of an incident that you were targeted in Athlone in January, where you were questioned by a man in what I think any objective person would call very aggressive and intimidating manner. To be honest, from the outside looking in, politics looks like a dog's life. Would you recommend it as a career to anybody? You know, it looks really tough.
Well, I think if you followed it in social media, you certainly would be very put off by it, because some of the abuse that goes on there is not acceptable, and in any walk of life. But I mean, I have to, like, in terms of in real life and meeting people face to face, that's, you know, it's a different story in my view, you know. You can have disagreements with people or different views and policies, but actually engage and work out a way forward. So listen, I mean, I would have, as you know, in terms of, say, putting this, the current common agriculture policy together, would have traveled to Martin every county in the country. And anyone, no matter how aggressive they were or how contrarian their view would have been on any issue, had their chance there to come along and front up in relation to putting their view. And there's plenty that did. And we had really good and robust discussions on it. And that was very healthy. But you do find then across the board, there's a lot of people whose focus is on trying to generate material for social media. That's the specific purpose. It's not about engaging. Like, so, for example, that particular incident in Athlone, I had just finished a meeting with about 250 farmers at the Irish Cattle and Sheep Association, where I'd spent, as I always do, I'd spent over 2 hours answering questions for 250 farmers from right across the country. But the few that came in afterwards, they weren't interested in asking me questions. They were only looking for social media content to put up so that then they could create a whole hullabaloo about it and try and make themselves into some sort of heroes. But wouldn't come in or join an organization or even join a meeting whereby they'd have to talk about their issues, talk about what their policies might be or their views. I would avoid that at all costs. It's about getting the 30 seconds or the minute, make it as dramatic as possible, and then try and, you know, and that's then what that sort of stuff does travel on social media. So you could spend 10 hours or 20 hours doing serious stuff and engaging in a serious way, but it's the dramatic piece that then might travel. So listen, I think that's something we just have to call out and sift through. I think there's that evolution going on there whereby, you know, the whole social media space has been finding its feet, and what would have initially started off as potentially a really good tool in terms of informing people has become quite abusive and corrosive generally. Like, if you look at the abuse which, you know, any politician will get on social media, and the abuse we would get would be, you know, can be seen publicly. It just tells you the how dangerous a tool that can be in terms of other people's private lives and young people's lives, because, you know, if adults are, you know, on supposedly fully fledged individuals are acting like that in social media, it really concerns me about what are so many people dealing with under the surface in their private lives, which we can't see, and young people in particular. And it's something that Tánaiste called out at the Fianna Fáil Ardéis at the weekend, really, as the as social media and the abuse of it and being really the key health issue of our time. And how we address that. But it certainly, listen, it makes it more difficult to be in politics than it would have been when I started off. But I suppose of all people, the people that are best equipped to deal with it would probably be politicians, because we're used to robust engagement. But to me, it just speaks to a much wider challenge we have in terms of making sure that people, that everybody gets educated to make, and hopefully that we find ways to protect people from the very damaging effects it has.
You obviously have great resilience that you can brush off, you know, that type of incident, but you've years under your belt as a politician. That type of incident, you'd have to say, would make someone thinking of going into politics. And, you know, you're always looking for generational renewal is just as important, I'm sure, in politics as it is in farming. But to see what you and other politicians have had to put up with in terms of intimidation and aggressive behaviour, that surely, do you fear that that would have an effect on the people that are going to come into the next generation of politics? Will they come in at all?
Listen, it's definitely is off-putting. You know? And I have to say, though, politics and being a politician gives a great capacity to try and influence and do, you know, positive things in the space, and particularly, you know, as Minister for Agriculture, Food and the Marine, in terms of supporting farmers at times of need, whether that's most recently, you know, in terms of the harvest, or last year in terms of the harvest, or the pig sector when they're in trouble, or indeed, you know, during the Ukrainian challenge in terms of the fodder schemes we put in place, or that type of thing. So you have a great chance to try or delivering the cap, okay, doing that. But it can be off-putting, and it's probably more off-putting for others. Listen, I'm a 6'4" male, and so in terms of, you know, being you know, coming into situations where you might be, you know, like that situation, you know, it's hard to put yourself in somebody else's shoes. So, you know, but it's not the norm in terms of, that's the only time I'd have to say I come across that type. And I've gone through many protests over the time, normally would have gone out and engaged with most protests as well and talked to people. So that's not, that wouldn't necessarily be the norm. But the thing I've seen change since I got involved in politics, I suppose, in a broader sense, is this, that it used to be the case that politics, you know, delivery was about doing things and getting results and delivering in terms of, you know, delivering projects in your area or delivering supports, let's say, for farmers, or making a real, you know, effort, making a real impact, a tangible impact. And that was what was regarded as delivery. And with, particularly through social media now, I think what we're seeing more is that the delivery now is more often regarded as, well, as somebody willing to, is somebody repeating or saying what I want to hear. Right. And if you're telling people what they want to hear, oh, well, they say, oh, well, that person's delivering for me, you know, because they're saying what I want to hear right now. And that's now more often regarded as delivery than the hard graft of maybe grappling with an issue and coming up with the best possible outcome, but which mightn't necessarily be, you know, what people would have fully wanted, but which is delivery. But then somebody who's saying, oh, listen, you don't care enough. All you have to do is do the snapshot on social media, or the clip from the doll shouting and roaring. And even though they're delivering nothing, but by virtue of every day echoing what people might want to hear, that's regarded as delivery now. And that just makes politics more difficult, because that means that the people aren't delivering anything at all are seen to be the ones that are chiming. And they can always be in that position. Whereas the ones that actually are getting stuck in and trying to deliver something are the ones that you're more open to criticism and people saying, oh, well, it should have been this way or it should have been that way. And in the past, before social media, that just simply saying what people wanted to hear wouldn't have the same traction as it does now, because that 30-second clip now, or that 1-minute clip, that gets traveled, whereas hard graft and hard work is messier and not necessarily as doesn't travel as quickly on the social media sphere. But it does impact more on the ground and impact more in real life. It makes actual government a bit more challenging and makes real delivery more challenging, because once you get into that space of actually doing things, you're open for criticism. Whereas if you always stay on the opposition benches, and we see, you know, a growing number of independents and a growing number of parties are just very reluctant to move up the opposition benches, but because it's a much more comfortable place to be, because you can always be telling people what they want to hear and sound like you're a great fella or a great lady. But when you look back at it, and I see since my time I've been in politics or since I've been a minister, like the ones that are making the most noise and that maybe get the most traction on social media wouldn't have delivered anything in real life. But yet people would say, oh, they're the bee's knees, you know.
It doesn't sound like a hard graph translates very easily into a 30-second TikTok video. You mentioned there is work involved in being a minister. There's also work involved in being a minister who's Dublin-based, but from northwest rural county like Donegal. I'd be slated for asking a female minister this, but I'm going to ask you, what's it like juggling a ministerial career with family at home in Dublin? How do you make that work?
Yeah, well, listen, it's the biggest challenge, I think, whether you're, a male or female in politics, that is the biggest sacrifice, is the time commitment and the impact it has on your lifestyle and the out of hours aspect. And particularly, when you have a young family. So I have two boys, a seven-year-old and a 4-year-old. So that's a real challenge because you don't get to see them during the week. I try and keep the weekends as free in every way possible. So at least on a Saturday and a Sunday, I'm around. But that's the challenge. Listen, I certainly enjoy the work. I relish the challenge and relish the privilege and responsibility of being a minister for, particularly for agriculture, food and the marine, coming from a farming background myself. But it's that piece, and particularly the family piece, it's the biggest sacrifice people make. And particularly when you're not from Dublin, it becomes more challenging. But you have to manage it. And listen, but it's not specific. I mean, it's not specific to politics. I know here, been in Donegal, there's many, particularly in the construction sector, many people that head off to Dublin on a Monday morning and aren't back to a Friday. So it's not that dissimilar in that sense. So you've managed it best you can, but definitely it's the biggest downside.
I know we're running the clock on you now, Minister, but one last question, if you don't mind, is just for our listeners who have seen you, heard you on various podcasts, seen you in the pages of the Farmers Journal, heard you on the radio, seen you on RTE. You are from a farm in Donegal. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how does that influence where you're coming from as a minister when you're in Dublin and Brussels making those key decisions?
I mean, it's the full grounding, like you don't, once a farmer, always a farmer. My brother runs the farm at home now, but a farmer will always identify, very much with their, even as a farm, if you're farming full time or if you've only a small farm and you have another job up, people will still identify themselves as a farmer because it's very much part of who you are. And likewise, when you grow up in it, and I would have done it up until I was elected to the Dáil, really, where I didn't have the time anymore. But I have to say, I'm not sure, it'd be much more difficult, I would imagine. I can't imagine what it'd be like, but to do this job without having that grounding, because I know what it was like to grow up on the farm. We would have had a suckler beef and sheep farm. So you have an understanding of how farmers think, you have an understanding of the cycle of the year, all of the challenges around managing livestock, and of the difficulties of farming and the vagaries of farming. So that's a great, and also then the language and the feel for what farming and life in the countryside as a farmer is like. So that's a great grounding. Then what was also a great benefit to me alongside that was then the 3 or 4 years as opposition spokesperson in agriculture, because that was good. So between both of those have greatly enabled me to take up the baton of being minister and to really go at it in a strong way, and in terms of delivering this cap, in terms of delivering in the manifesto commitments that I made last time, whether that's the new environmental scheme, the acres, or the 200 euro suckler cow, or 20 euro a yo, or whatever. But so listen, it's a great privilege as well as a responsibility. But growing up on a farm, I really value where I am today, because I never would have thought, growing up at home with my father, my brothers, that someday you'd be Minister for Agriculture, Food and the Marine. So that's a wonderful honor in life, as well as a responsibility in life, and I feel that responsibility very much in everything that I do, then to do the very best I can in terms of getting a good outcome for farmers and for farm families, and I feel that background I have places me in a very strong position to do the best I can for the farming sector.
Minister for Agriculture, Charlie McConnell, thanks so much for taking the time to join us today. As I said, this is our 1,000th podcast, so it's a landmark for us. As I said, you've been involved in agricultural politics for most of that time. I'm sure you will be for a long time to come. So thanks again for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thanks very much, Katrina.
Excellent. Great to hear from the Minister and Katrina on all things good in the world of the Department of Ag. Right, let's go and try and capture our news editor, Amy Ford. Amy, answer the phone now.
Hi.
Amy, how are you?
Good, how's things?
Good, not too bad. How's things in the West?
Things in the West are good. Things in the West are drying out a bit.
I'd say so, like. And, like, in fairness, you're a bit like Adam, always complaining about the wet and the rain. Yeah, I talked to him earlier there in the show about the 1,000 days of rain. I think I talked to Siobhan as well about the 1,000 days of rain that we've had. Like, things are good. Things are happening in the fields, Amy, out in Galway, are they?
Fertiliser spreading, slurry going out, ploughing, everything actually kicking off. We're used to a longer winter over here anyway, so sure, fodder-wise, we're well prepared.
God bless you, I'm bringing out the violin again now. Yeah, excellent. Amy, listen, I'll tell you, we're just having this is a special recording of the 1000 podcast. Great to have you on the show. I mean, as news editor, you keep an eye on everything that's happening news wise in the farming side of the business, the news pod, and what you do every week. Tell us what you do. Do you put any work into that, or is it just kind of having the chat?
Mix of both, Jack. Everything is in the news podcast, really a reflection of what's in the paper that week and the top stories that are there. So more recent times, obviously, or over the last number of years, I suppose, really, COVID-19 pandemic, the beef protests, further consolidation in the beef and dairy industries, obviously the whole post-quota era and everything that's come since 2015, really, and whatever is, and cap changes, obviously, we can't forget the cap changes. They're massively impacted.
But how, come here, how does the team go about, like, because I mean you're involved, but there's lots of other your team involved as well in terms of kind of capturing some of the sound of what happens in that particular week. Like, how do you go about it? How do you put it together?
Yeah, so we look through the paper on a given week and look at the top stories and what's there and what matters most to farmers, really, and then we decide who needs to go on and talk about what topics. We will have the news team will drives it really, and then we might pull in Adam, as you said there, Adam, yeah, or Aidan, Juan or Darren, on the other sectors of maybe a bigger story that's happening in their relevant sectors of a given week, and we talk through that story and possibly where it might go next or what could happen next. Light bit, a bit of crystal ball gazing from time to time.
In terms of picking the big stories, Amy, from kind of week to week, like, I mean, obviously you've people submitting copy to you and campaigning for what they feel is the best story, and I'm sure not alone staff but farmers all over the country are kind of submitting copy to you and kind of are looking to get you on the phone or looking to hear and get their story heard. How do you kind of manage, how do you juggle all that? Like, how does it work?
Plenty of news pages, plenty of ad commercial will like me for saying that. Look, there's, I suppose it's all delegated or put aside based on its importance.
So what you're telling me is you're curating the copy. You're kind of trying to identify what's important for farmers and trying to pull that out and give it more prominence depending on the weighting you have on that particular story. Is that it?
That's it exactly, yeah. Depending on the story, obviously, and the number of farmers impacted and how it's going to really change what's happening inside their farm gate, really.
Yeah. The dealer page, Amy, do you want to reveal the person behind the dealer?
Not at all. That is a well-guarded, a closely guarded secret.
Come on, wait, Amy. No, this is the 1,000 podcast. This is a special podcast. This is the 1,000 podcast. Surely you need to give us some little nuggets that, you know, that people can kind of take away and give them something different. Like, come on, could you reveal the gender?
Location, the dealer, county, the dealer sees region. And hears plenty. Around the country, and that's all we can say on that.
Would you believe everything that's on the dealer page? Like, would you believe everything that's on the dealer page?
The dealer asked some very pertinent questions. Yes, of course we would. Very pertinent questions buried in there in the dealer page of things that are going on from Mizzen down up and down to Mallon and back again every week.
Yeah. Hey, listen, another key page
in the paper.
It is another favourite of mine. My farming week, in fairness, is just short and sweet. It captures what's happening on a farm in various parts of the country. You travel about to get that page.
We do. We like a good region that's spreading it. And anyone that would like to feature in My Farmer Week, given this is the 1,000th podcast, you know, should drop us a line to news@farmersjournal.ie if I can put in a shameless plug.
Excellent. Amy, 100%. Listen, thanks for having the chat. We'll talk to you again.
Thanks, Jack.
That's it for our special 1,000 podcast from Team IFJ. I hope you've enjoyed this compilation and all our pods on a weekly basis. Thanks to all our supporters for helping us make our pods happen. Thanks to you for listening. Thanks to our contributors today, Siobhan, Adam, Kira, Amy, Philip and Katrina and the Minister for Agriculture. Thanks again to you for your feedback. If you'd like to provide any more feedback, WhatsApp 086836 6465. Remember, you can listen back to any of the recent webinars or podcasts on ifj.ie/podcast. Remember also, you can enter our 1,000 euro giveaway by clicking on the link in the show notes or scanning the QR code in the full page advert in this week's Irish Farmers Journal. Until next time, stay safe and safe farming.
This special 1,000 podcast is brought to you in association with Crone, distributed by Farmhand.